Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck sticks, what the fuckleberry fins? What's going on? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. How are you? It's been kind of a rough week. It's difficult, but we're moving through it. Today on the show, Bob Mould, from Husker Du, from Sugar, from Bob Mould, from a lot of things that you may not know about Bob Mould. Bob Mould is an amazing guitar player and songwriter and creative force of nature. I was so thrilled to have him in my garage and talk to him. He played guitar. It was amazing. It was fucking amazing. His new album is available everywhere, including mergerecords.com/shop, where you get a 20% off with the offer code WTF. You can also check out his tour dates at mergerecords.com. Bob Mould, shortly. This guy made some of the best fucking rock music in the world ever. Reinvented it. Husker Du is monstrous in a good way. And Sugar, Copper Blue, I mean, those Sugar records, fucking great. And such a sweet guy. Look forward to that conversation coming up in mere minutes. Mere minutes, my friends. What else do I want to tell you about? Maron, on the IFC show Maron, is premiering on Fox TV in the UK tonight at 11 p.m. And in Ireland, I believe, and probably other places that I should know but don't know. That's the first season of Maron, so enjoy that, my friends in England and Ireland. Enjoy it. I haven't told you about, obviously we had the repost of the Robin Williams interview with my thoughts in the immediate aftermath of learning of his death. That's a real hard one, folks. It's gonna hurt a while. But earlier that day, we posted an amazing interview with Bob Newhart that was a complete honor to me to do. I just want to remind you that that's up there because the Robin Williams interview went up the same day. Both of them legends. Both of them beautiful people. Great artists. So sad to lose Robin. And so amazing to have Bob still with us. But since I've last talked to you, I've done three of the Oddball Festival dates. I'll be honest with you, man. Before I forget, Charlotte, North Carolina tonight at the Comedy Zone. Tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday. I know I was just there at Oddball, but I'll be there tonight doing the hour plus. Tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday, come down. But I was just in Charlotte. I was just in Tampa. I was just in Atlanta. Doing the Oddball Festival. Now, as I said before, I'm going to be honest with you people. I've never played for 10,000 fucking people. Are you kidding me? I've been doing comedy half my life, 25 years. You know, I could sell out maybe 1,000 in some of my good markets. Really good markets. I'm more of a 500 to 900 seat guy. 10,000 people. And I was going a little crazy. I was really stressed out for weeks leading up to these Oddball Festival dates. The acts on the show, Jeffrey Ross emceed. It was Brent Morin, and then me, and then Reggie Watts, Hannibal Buress, and then Chris Hardwick, Aziz Ansari, and Louis C.K. That's a monster show. 10,000 seats were sold, and I was driving myself crazy because a lot of you who know or have witnessed my evolution as a performer, I've been moving the other way. I'm not trying to get bigger. I'm trying to get smaller. I'm trying to get mark-sized. I'm trying to have the same lack of boundaries and candidness and intimacy with my stand-up as I do with here in the garage or when I'm having dinner. That's sort of what I do. Like I believe that the training and the craft will be sublimated, internalized, which it is, after half my life doing this, 25 years or so, and that will all be in place and I never have to think about it. And that's the beauty of it. That's sort of like, you know, driving in a way. That the machine will take care of itself. I just have to be in the present, let my brain do its thing. Be in the moment. Make the funny happen. In the moment if possible. But when you're about to play for 10,000 to 15,000 people, you're like, I better have a fucking set. It better be tight. There better be tags. Because I know what happens. You get up on a stage that big with that many people. You got to roll out those jokes and you got to wait for that response to come back. And you've got to sort of get a sense of the timing of maybe 8,000 of the 10,000 who are paying attention or laughing deeply and figure out how to pace yourself. But you can't, don't leave any hangers. Don't have any sort of noodling jokes. Make sure there are beats at the end, that there's closure. It's like when you prepare for a Letterman set or a short set or a 4.5 minute set. I don't know if that's the greatest representation of me, but it's a skill unto itself to put together that set and make it punchline efficient and make it work. And it's the same sort of effort you have to bring to a 15-minute set. I was doing 15s. Everyone was doing 15, except, well, Hannibal did 25, Aziz did 25, Louis did 30. But me, Reggie, Chris, Brent, Jeff was hosting. They were just 15-minute spots. So in my mind, it's like, how bad could it go in 15 minutes? Well, it could hurt pretty bad. But why would it hurt, man? Why would it hurt, Mark? You've been doing this 25 years. Well, sometimes when you get in front of a huge audience, it's the loneliest place in the world. And you can just feel it. Sometimes if you're not locked in and you're not doing your show and you're just a guy standing by himself on a big old stage in front of 10 to 15,000 people, you might want to disappear. There's a little part of you that wants to disappear, but there's another party that wants to go, look at me. Who's going to win? Well, when you're a professional, that guy. Who's going to win? That guy. The guy who's, look at me, listen to me. I'm trying to put some love out there, at least trying to make you laugh, doing a show. So I wrestled with that fucking thing. I wrestled right, you know, you got to get that first one in, you know? And I was nervous and anxious and everything else, and I didn't know what set I was going to do, and I knew I was going to lean into it too hard, because I'm in my mind, I'm like, I know how to get big. I've been big before. I spent over half of my career just hammering away. And am I going to have to do that? Am I? So let's get back to Tampa, Florida. First night of Oddball Fest. I'm freaking out. It's hot as fuck. It might be raining. I'm scribbling my set minutes before I have to go on. I've been scribbling it on and off all day. I want to do some local stuff. You know, I want to plant myself in the situation. I want to hit hard. It's still light outside. But I'm not letting any of this stuff fuck with my head, because I know I got to show up for work. There would have been a time in my life where I would have been freaking myself to the point of paralysis. But I've been doing this a long time. I don't need to do that to myself, but I'm still pretty scared. And I made the decision to wear my jean shorts. That's right, folks. Not only do I not know what I'm going to do exactly when I get on stage in front of 10,000 people, but I'm like, fuck it, it's hot. I'm wearing jorts. I'm going to wear jorts. That's who I am today. And it's like, honestly, Tampa is one of the only places in the world where if you wear jorts, you're actually pandering. So I got up there with my jean cutoffs and I leaned into it and I focused and I regressed in a way to old Mark energy and just stayed on top of it. But I killed. I did pretty good. Everything hit. It was nice. It was a good feeling. And I'm like, all right, got that under my belt. Everyone did great. The second half of the show, it's nighttime. So they get there's the two things that happened there. I was talking to Louie about it. At nighttime, it's like, yeah, there's more focus because they're not looking at each other and wondering why everyone's sitting outside. But at night, they got focus. You got a stage. You can't, you know, that's all you got to look at. But Louie also pointed out, well, also by the intermission, you know, they've had a few more cocktails. But either way, quite honestly, everybody killed. Everyone did great. The audiences were great. My panic was, how is this a good environment to do stand-up in? It seems antithetical. And then someone pointed out to me, dude, they're coming for that. It's a comedy festival. You're not opening up for a rock act. It's not like, shit, I got to do 20 before Tom Petty. Like, I had no idea what a fucking rush it could be. But when I went to fucking Charlotte the next night, I was like, I got this. I'm going to mix it up. I'm down south. I'm going to talk about Jesus. I'm going to do what Mark Maron said. I'm going to do what I do. I'm not going to fucking freak out and lean into it too hard. Just do what you do in that situation, Mark. You're in front of 11,000 people. Just do it. You're professional. It's fucking awesome. It was great hanging out with the comics. Had a great time hanging out with Brent Morin and Ross and Hardwick. And I hung out with Louie. Yeah, I love it. It's great to see the guys. And, you know, I'm going to be at the ones. I'm not at all of them, but I will be at the ones in Austin, Houston, in Dallas coming up. I'll be at the ones up in Mountain View and the one in Irvine. I'll also be at Red Rocks in Denver. I guess what I'm telling you is I recommend it. Go out to the Oddball Fest because, you know, I was a little skeptical as a performer, but it's pretty amazing. And it's not like anything you'll ever see, you know, before. It's arena comedy and it's fucking great professional comics. I mean, Gaffigan's doing some, Burr's doing some, Silverman's doing some, Attell's doing some. Great comics, you know, everywhere. I was walking around at intermission and when I was off stage with my pass, meet and greet, some random photos, watching the show from the audience, watching one of my friends up on stage do his thing in front of the 10, 11,000 people. Spectacular. I will be honest with you, though. I only wore the jorts the first night. I was thinking, like, this is going to be my thing. I'm going to be the jorts guy on the festival. But jorts only happened in Tampa, and that's where they were supposed to happen. You get it? You with me, Florida? Huh? You know what I'm saying. You know what's going on down there. A lot of crazy shit. All right, man, it's my fucking pleasure right now because I just getting to know this guy. We'd met a couple of times. He rocks hard. He's an original. And I was thrilled to talk to him, and I learned a bunch of really interesting stuff. So let's go now to my conversation with Bob.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Old. Can you hear? Is that how you're going to wear the headphones?
Pretty good, yep.
That's how you do it?
Yep, that's how I do it.
Stick one on your head,
yep.
One on your ear.
Yep, in case. Just in case I go deaf.
How is your hearing?
It's not bad. It's not bad. I think I have tinnitus because it's gone through three distinct phases.
Yeah.
You know, that first phase that I think everybody that goes to live shows, you know, at the, you know, you get to the, you get to your car or you get back on the bus and you have that...
Yeah.
It's for about 36 hours. So that's the first one.
Right.
And then there's mosquitoes.
Right.
Which is when frequencies start, you know, they come at you like a vacuum cleaner, like white noisy kind of things.
And yeah.
And then they just stop.
Yeah.
And like everything sounds different.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's that. And then now I started having the foghorn.
Really?
Yeah, which is like I'd be in bed at night sleeping on this side and then on this ear that I'm sleeping on, I would start hearing like...
Oh, come on, man. Really? But I have to assume that with Husker Du, you must have blown your fucking brains out, no?
That band didn't get super loud until the very end when we were playing bigger rooms and I could bring like tons of amps.
Yeah.
You know, the cymbals are a lot of what does it to people. Like in rehearsal spaces and the cymbals are at ear level and...
Oh, really?
Yeah, that sound, that shh all the time.
Well, you look incredibly healthy together.
Thank you.
Like, I saw you at Bumbershoot with Worcester.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you played like songs from the entire career.
Yeah.
You just go through the catalog. It must be amazing to have a fucking catalog the size that you have. Like, I was doing my research, and I always get nervous when I interview musicians because it's sort of like, I'm going to get up to speed. And then you get online, and you're like, oh, there's no fucking way I'm going to get up to speed.
No, you just, no.
you just, just just got to talk.
Yeah.
But I go all the way back. I mean, I listened to, I got the reissue of Zen Arcade, and then I picked up an original one, and then I was just listening to that second album. Uh-huh. And the pace and intensity of that music is unlike anything.
Yeah, there. Well, I mean, there was a lot of people in the late 70s and early 80s. I guess for, you know, for people who weren't around at that time, you know, there was that first wave of punk rock that everybody thinks about. Oh, Sex Pistols, Malcolm McLaren, Fashion, late 70s, you know, Silver Jubilee and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then the next iteration was this American hardcore that, you know, a lot of us started there. It started all over the country at once.
Like, who were the bands?
Well, I mean, in Los Angeles, there was, you know,
Black Flag,
Germs, Black Flag, stuff like that. Yeah. 45 Grave. You know, San Francisco, Dead Kennedys, Flipper. Then you go up to Vancouver, you know, DOA, Subhumans. Down in Austin, Texas, Big Boys, The Dicks. Minneapolis was Husker Du, Replacements, Soul Asylum.
All happened at once.
Yeah, Naked Ray Gun in Chicago, Strike Under. Yeah. Then all the Discord stuff in D.C., Minor Threat, SOA, which is where Henry Rollins
Fugazi.
Came from. Yep. All that kind of stuff. So, you know, it was this amazing thing where I think that first wave of punk, you know, whether it was Ramones,
American
Blondie
punk.
Television, or the Sex Pistols, Clash, Buzzcocks, the next wave was less about fashion and more about, you know, sort of changing the 70s AOR corporate rock arena thing. We were trying to build this network of new rooms that, you know, VFW halls play for $20, you know.
Just take the door or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you guys were all, everyone was into promoting themselves, flyers, fanzines, mailings.
Yeah. And
word of mouth.
And promoting other bands. So, you know, and this was before the internet. This was before cell phones. You know, everybody had notebooks, and these notebooks were like sacrosanct. You know, like, I got this band's manager's number. When we get to that town, we can call him.
And I talked to a lot of guys from that world, and you'd show up in town and you'd see who the local acts were to open, mm-hmm. or you'd open for somebody that was just coming through, that it was almost a friend circle.
Yeah, totally a friend circle. And you had to sort of be like a sleuth, like, okay, where's the indie record store that sells, you know, the hardcore punk stuff? And you'd find it, and then you get there and they'd say, oh, there's like a show at the you know, Indian reservation tomorrow night. You guys could probably get on that, you know. And you do these things, and you have these amazing experiences.
At the Indian Reservation.
In Reno, yeah.
Oh, okay.
With bands like 7 Seconds. They'd be, you know, I remember that. It's like we went to like some, I think it was like some like, you know, religious, you know, one of those music stores that supplies to like churches. And
right.
we would rent a PA and put it in a garage at this, you know, on a reservation and play for like 40 people.
Really?
Yeah, it was nuts. Yeah,
but that's like a specific memory. Indian Reservation, that didn't just pop into your head.
Well, I remember that because the flyer, they instead of Husker Du, they called us Who Screwed You. And I'm thinking, oh, this is a reservation. Of course, you know, so wrong. Sorry.
So where did you start playing guitar? Where'd you grow up?
I was born and raised in a small farm town in northern New York, a town called Malone.
Was your family in farming?
No. My mom was she worked at Bell Telephone. She was the night operator, like switchboard patching stuff. And
back when they did that,
yeah,
back when you could call, if you dialed 0, you could talk to your mother.
Yes, yeah, be gracious, and she could listen to all my calls. And that's what happened.
Yeah,
that's how they figured it out.
Yeah, they knew.
But when I was like six, seven years old, my parents bought like a mom and pop grocery store. So I grew up in like the Dobie Gillis setup, where it was the house, and then you go through the kitchen, and it was like a grocery store.
No. Yeah, so were you stocking shelves and stuff and running the register?
Running the register, the whole thing.
And what's your dad's name?
Willis.
So it's like, that's Willis's boy.
That's Willis's boy, yeah.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, oldest sister Susan and an older brother Brian.
Are they all right?
Yeah, they're doing good.
Well, good. And then when did the guitar come in? When did your mind get blown? I mean, what were you like in school when you were a kid?
Well, smart kid, too smart probably.
Yeah.
You know, just had a gift for numbers.
Did you feel out of place?
Yeah, for a lot of reasons.
Uh-huh.
But my dad was a horn player in the Air Force, but he never played music around me. But the one thing that he did was when they got the grocery store, he would have to buy cigarettes and stuff from the people who stocked the jukeboxes.
Okay.
And when they pulled the singles off, like in 1966, he would go and buy boxes of them for a penny a piece. And those were my toys as a kid.
The 45s from the late 60s,
mid-late 60s, like Beatles, Beach Boys, Dave Clark, Five Mamas and Papas, Motown, Monkees, everything.
Do you regret that you don't have the box anymore?
I have all of them.
You still have all of them?
All of them except a stack of Motown ones that got stolen when I was going to DJ a soul night in my college.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, no. They sit front and center in my workroom.
Really?
Yeah. I look over here. You have a shelf. Mine sit right there.
Now, just in a row? Like, yeah, how many
three,
are we talking?
Three beer crates full of singles.
I do that. What were they with the picture covers or no? Or just
no, like the just no regular, no regular dust sleeves even because they just came out of the jukebox. They were all beat up.
And those were the things that you listened to early on. And do you remember which ones were like, holy shit?
Well, it's funny because I just did a show at Carnegie Hall. It was a songbook tribute show for Paul Simon.
Uh-huh.
And one of the songs that I remember as a kid was the song "Faking It." Was from Bookends.
Yeah, it's a great song.
And the reason I remember it is I used to memorize label copy, and the running length of that song was 2 minutes and 74 seconds.
Yeah.
Because in those days, you had to stay under 3 minutes or they wouldn't play it.
Right.
So they tried to...
Slip it through?
Yeah.
That's a good song. Did you play a song on that show?
Yeah, I just played... Yeah, I played
you,
that... Faking
It?
Yeah, I played Carnegie earlier this year, yeah.
And for Paul Simon?
Yeah.
And it was just a bunch of you guys playing Paul Simon music?
Yeah, we had, it was like John Doe, Judy Collins, Sam from Sam and Dave, the Wilson sisters from Heart.
And did Paul come out at the end?
Nope.
He didn't?
No,
he wasn't even there?
No, of course not.
That's interesting. So how does a show like that get booked? How does someone decide to do that? He must have sanctioned it, correct?
Well, it's a friend of mine. His name is Michael Dorf. He started the Knitting Factory in New York and then here. And now he has these venues called City Winery that are showing up around the country. And every year we do this. He does these shows that raise money for underserved kids in New York City for musical instruments and lessons.
Uh-huh.
So, and I'm very fortunate every couple of years he will have me on one of the shows.
So that's sweet. But did you guys do a record as well?
No, it's just a number of bands played for a couple hours at Carnegie Hall and that was it.
So you're a math kid and you're listening to rock and roll.
Yep.
And that one had an impression on you because like that's catchy. You know, Faking It is catchy.
Yeah, or Good Vibrations.
What kind of horns your dad play?
Alto sax.
Okay. So he could jam? Could he blast?
He never played in front of me.
You never know? You didn't
know
at all?
Not one note in front of me. I knew he had the horn. He never took it out.
Bizarre.
But he got me the singles. And also, my grandmother would take care of me a lot.
Yeah.
And she cared for a woman that got struck by lightning.
Huh.
Who was, hard to move and couldn't move on her own. And in the house that this woman lived, there was a baby grand. And I would put on the AM radio and sit at the piano and I would hear a song and I would be able to figure it out.
On the piano?
On the piano.
And so you had a knack for it?
Yeah, so I heard these songs. I had these singles. I sort of figured out music theory.
What was
just
the lady
who
got struck by lightning doing when you were doing that? Just sitting there?
She was in the other room.
Okay.
She's getting bathed or something that I didn't.
So it was like over for that lady.
No, she was okay. It was just hard, you know. It wasn't so she was like frazzled.
That's either a strike of bad luck or amazing luck. I don't know how that goes. What does it mean when you get struck by lightning? I'll read into anything, Bob.
I have heard people have had gotten struck by lightning at least twice.
That, you've got to start thinking that you're not meant to be if you get struck by lightning.
You
got to
take off the tin hat.
Wrong headgear.
Yes.
All right, so you start plinking around on piano and you could figure it out.
Doing that, and then I got one of those little Emini plastic chord organs. You know, the ones where they had the chord buttons on the left and then the keyboard on the right.
Yeah.
And then I started writing songs when I was 9.
Uh-huh.
So I did that for a little while.
Did Husker Du cover any of those?
No. I'm saving those till the end. Because it all, you know how this goes.
Sure,
you save the beginning till the end.
When they make sense again.
Yeah. Yeah. Where's my oatmeal?
Exactly.
I got a song. So I would write these cute little songs about my dog and about my mom and stuff, you know. And then I sort of, you know, as I got 11, 12 years old, I started to, you know, drop away from music for a little bit, got into sports, started listening to not bad music, but what my friends were listening to.
Right, townie rock?
Yeah, well, you know, like Foghat, Fleetwood Mac.
Fool got for into, the City, man.
Got into Kiss.
Yeah.
And then...
Zeppelin?
No, I hated Zeppelin.
How is that?
I love those guys now, but because when the Beatles broke up, I remember the article in the New York Daily News that said, the Beatles are over and the heir apparent is a new blues outfit called Led Zeppelin. And I was like, there's going to be another fucking Beatles.
You're a big Beatles guy?
Very loyal. Very loyal. Yeah. I'm not a Stones guy. I'm a Beatles guy.
There's no room for both?
There is now, but when you're 9 and the Beatles break up and they're trying to sell you Led Zeppelin, it's like, no fucking way.
Right, I get that. I want to go back because I'm trying to track this. It's my belief, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Like, I listened to the, you know, the first couple Husker Du records, mm-hmm. and you seem furious.
Yes. Like, scorched earth.
Yeah.
That was the idea.
I mean, I see pictures and I'm like, oh my God, this guy looked like he was about to explode.
Yes. Lots of things.
Yeah. Well, how did that, how did you get there? I mean, when did you start playing guitar and when did you, you know, start shredding yourself from the inside?
Well, I picked up, for my 16th birthday, I asked for and received the first Ramones album.
Yeah.
From my folks. And when I heard that record, everything changed. I mean, I had like a SG copy that I bought in a Sears catalog. And, you know, I would like lip sync to Kiss and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was writing, you know, trying to write like songs. But then when I heard the Ramones, everything changed. I was just like, this is it. Anybody can do this now.
Right.
It's not makeup and Learjets and scarves and, you know, all right. that stuff. It's these guys on the street. Playing this really
basic
fundamental music.
Yeah.
So that changed my world. That was when I said, I can learn this and I can do this. I moved from Northern New York State to the Twin Cities in the fall of 1978 to go to McAllister College.
Yeah.
Small liberal arts school. I got a, I got the underprivileged full scholarship.
Nice.
My parents were poverty level. So I got that.
Did they keep the store though all the way through?
Oh yeah, they kept all that. But
yeah.
We had no money, so this right. was my way out of a out
How'd
of this
you pick
farm
that
town.
School? You were just looking.
I applied to a lot of schools. This yeah. farm town, you know, by this point, I knew I was gay. I knew I had to get out of the small town.
Right.
And I
just
knew
because your options were limited, or because of the hate.
both, and you know, just looking for opportunity, wanting a better life, and so I was 17, moved to the Twin Cities. There was a record store really close to the campus called Cheapo Records. That's where I met the drummer.
Still there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where I met Grant Hart, the drummer and other songwriter in Husker Du.
Do you guys get along now?
We communicate, but you know, we're both really difficult. let's not beat
Apparently.
Around the bush.
Yeah.
We both have our ways of doing things, and you do this thing. I mean,
yeah, band dynamics is something is beyond me, but I guess, because I don't understand, I'm never in a band. But like in my mind, like when I hear about guys like you guys or like Dinosaur Jr., I'm like, you can't keep it together.
Or the Smiths.
You know, or the Smiths.
Morrissey and Mara, that's
Or anyway,
classic.
Soundgarden.
Oh.
Yeah, but it's just sort of like there are these moments where it's like, you guys were just about to be bigger than life.
Yes.
But there's too big a problem.
Yeah, but you're but most rock musicians have this self-defeatist thing. Like it's the fear of success, I think. Or,
I guess.
Yeah, just like, oh no, I'm going to be huge, and maybe they'll figure out that I only really know three chords.
But that's all you need.
I know that
but
now.
You, but it's funny, you know so many more than three chords. Because that's weird. So you took the Ramones on, but you were just plinking around on guitar? You must have learned those Beatle chords at some point.
Oh yeah. Learn, you know, just self-taught, figured, you know, listen to records, figured stuff out, and then
because you write, you use all those pop chords. You're not a Ramones player.
I was like that early on, but then I figured out how to, you know, I figured out I had to do more stuff, you know, look to like Townsend,
uh-huh.
you know, and that, you know, the janglier open chords and stuff
right.
like that. Play two parts at once on the guitar.
You're an amazing guitar player.
Oh, thanks. It's an interesting style.
So you go to Cheapo's.
Go to Cheapo. We meet. Grant says, I know this guy, Greg Norton. He works at Northern Lights Records down the street. He's got a bass guitar. Maybe we can get together and play music in the basement over there because it's a bigger basement than Cheapo's got.
Yeah.
So we got together. We had a keyboard player for a couple shows. Nice fellow named Charlie Pine.
But a synth or?
Oh, Farfisa.
Oh, really?
So we would do stuff like Sea Cruise and stuff. So, but it was great. So we were playing. The first shows were at these, like a 3-2 bar in the Twin Cities. And for people who don't know Minnesota, drinking 3.2% alcohol.
Half beer.
Yeah, that's what they
near
serve.
Near beer.
Yeah, near beer at a 3-2 bar. So we would do like a couple sets like Sea Cruise mixed in with, you know, Fast Cars by the Buzzcocks and uh-huh. Non-Alignment Pack by Para Ubu. And
Sea Cruise, you mean that the old song?
Won't you let me take you on a
Didn't Robert Gordon, he covered that, right?
Yeah. So we did, you know, we did that
because
Charlie liked that.
Yeah.
But then at the end of the we did two nights, and at the end of the second night, we asked him to leave the stage, and we had already written 5 or 6 songs, and we did those on our own.
Were they on any of the records?
I think a couple might have made it on a Land Speed record. So that was, this is like the spring of 79, We did that, and then we started, you know, started trying to play at the punk rock bars in the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
Started meeting other bands, other musicians, and
Replacements.
Yeah, Replacements started right about that time.
Were you guys friends?
Yeah, we were friends. Friendly rivalry.
Uh huh.
Yeah,
because you were both at it at the same time.
Yeah. Well, the Replacements, you know, great band. There's a fellow named Peter Jesperson who worked at a record store, and he sort of took the Replacements under his wing and brought them over to Twin Tone Records.
Right.
And then we sent a demo to Twin Tone, and they said, we don't, you know, we can't agree on it, so we don't want to work with you guys. So we were like, well, fuck y'all. So we just said, well, we're going to do it our own way.
Yeah.
And then we started tapping into this hardcore punk network. And
they're definitely a Stones band.
Yeah. Totally. They're a rock and roll band. We were like, we are not a rock and roll band. So we had this friendly rivalry, but Paul and I would hang out and listen to music together and throw ideas around. So it was...
Drink?
Yeah, a little bit.
What'd you drink back then?
A lot, everything.
Yeah.
But mostly, you know, like beer, cheap wine.
Yeah.
Depends. Different records was, you know, along the way were different alcohols.
So you would sit with Westerberg and listen to records and have conversations about music?
Yeah. Yeah, and with Peter Jesperson and with Chris Mars. And we'd listen to stuff, talk to stuff. Peter would try to educate us because he was the record store guy.
And what was his take?
You know, stuff like Only Ones, you know. And
Another Girl, Another Planet, which the Replacements covered.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you guys do that too?
Nope.
No.
They got to it first.
That's the only song though, isn't it?
What?
Isn't that their big song?
What? Only Ones? Yeah.
I mean, I tried to listen to the rest of it. It's okay, but it's not that song.
No. They had a great song there, but it it'd be that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it was a great time up there. You know, the late 70s through the mid 80s in Minneapolis was really exciting.
Well, it's freezing. And but like you said, all these great bands, especially you guys and the Replacements, come out of there. But like, what was what led to like Zen Arcade was this huge record for you guys and was a huge record for the form.
Yes.
Because I listen to your music, I still can't identify it as punk rock necessarily, because you got all those pop chords in there, and there was some sort of organization around how you wrote songs that was different. And how did you wrestle with that stuff? I mean, what was your process?
Well, when we started coming out to the West Coast in the early 80s, we saw, you know, all this stuff, Kennedy's Black Flag, Flipper, all this, you know, really nihilistic, you know, punk rock thing. And we were like, oh, this is sort of cool. Let's tap into this for a little bit. You know, we sort of play like this anyways, and people liked it. And after about a year and a half, 2 years of that, we're just like, man, there's a lot of rules in this thing. You know,
what do you
mean? You got to wear this chain that way, and you got to hate this particular kind of politics. It was just like all these rules, and we're like, what are these rules about? We want to make music. So, you know, with Zen Arcade, that was the big break away from hardcore and way toward, you know, we really wanted to make more of a personal statement.
Yeah.
And, you know, Zen Arcade is, you know, it's a loose concept record, sort of tying all three of us together. And, you know, we had this, you know, sort of storyline of this kid that designed, you know, video games, and he made this game called Search, you know, and had this girlfriend that died. And
so you guys, you know, all sat down and wrote a story.
We were writing songs, and when we saw that it all fit together, then we started creating characters as a way to sort of pin the thing together.
Right.
And then it became, you know, it's not as methodical as like Quadrophenia, but, you know, it was pretty ambitious at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Minutemen saw that, and they were like, we want to make a double album too. So they did Double Nickels and the Dime, you know. And, you know, the Minutemen, for people who don't know their music or never got to see that band, I mean, to really understand late 20th century American, you know, like West Coast rock,
you know,
that sort of funky thing, you really have to go back and look at those Minutemen records. So influential.
It took me a long time to wrap my brain around the Minutemen, and then Firehose, because my friend Dave Cross was a huge Firehose guy. But even that, like, because I'm such a blues-based idiot, like, I didn't, you know, I just didn't understand the drive. Even when the first time I heard your band, I was like, dude, it's too much going on, and where's the hook? Where's the hook?
Yeah.
And, but it took me a long time to get it. But all those SST guys were kind of influential.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, Black Flag was so important to the Los Angeles, that whole, you know, anti-police culture, you know, Ray Pettibone with all those graphics.
Yeah.
I mean, that stuff was really subversive and provocative. And the police would come by SST, you know, and, you know, sort of harass people who worked there in the bands. And
yeah.
So that was
you were down here living here?
We would come and stay for a couple weeks at a time.
Like, who'd you stay with?
We would sleep at the SST office, which was maybe 300 square feet.
Yeah.
And people would sleep under desks.
What was the idea? What was the idea of SST? I mean, who's that label? I mean, it's not around anymore. But you were on their Black Flag, the Minutemen, right? Firehose,
Minutemen, Meat Puppets, and then later Soundgarden, Sonic Youth, Dinosaur Jr. I mean,
that's right. They were all there. Did you feel like it was a community?
Yep. Yeah, it felt like a community. I mean, Chuck Dukowski, the bass player from Black Flag, he would book tours for bands, and he was really helpful to us. You know, Rollins, I mean, when Black Flag would go on tour, we would stay at SST and, you know, I would sleep under, you know, under the desk where Henry would sleep when he was there, when he wasn't sleeping in the tool shed or wherever it was.
Now, were you guys all wasted all the time?
Hooskers could party down.
Yeah.
Yeah. We knew how to use those food stamps for generic beer.
Generic beer, black and white labels. Yes. I forgot about that.
Beer.
The Meat Puppets, were you friends with those guys?
Yeah, we went through Phoenix. They were crazy.
Yeah.
They were wild guys.
Trippy.
God, they were just like, I mean, it was like beef heart, psychedelia, meets Crazy Horse, meets super
meets country.
Yeah, fast punk rock and, you know, all that, like the mid-60s psychedelic stuff that they wove in.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah, and I love that you guys all knew each other and you just hung out.
Yeah.
So, all right, so you do Zen Arcade, you do this big concept album, and all of a sudden now you're defining a new genre.
Yes.
And there's pressure now.
Yes.
And what happened?
Make another record as quickly as possible
but
and
a
don't
label
think
record?
About it.
No, no.
Yeah, we made New Day Rising, came out 5 months later.
That was SST, right?
It was still SST.
That was 6 months later?
Yeah, Zen Arcade came out, well, the first, at July 84, there was 3,000 copies pressed that sold instantly. SST didn't press it back, didn't get it back in stock till September of 84.
I guess that's the liability of the small label.
Yeah, so, yes, indeed. So January 85, we put out New Day Rising.
Yeah.
And then September of 85, we put out Flip Your Wig. And that was, by then, the major labels were at us.
Yeah.
And we could have taken Flip Your Wig to Warner Brothers, but, you know, we had a sense of loyalty, and we felt like, you know, on the way out that we sort of wanted to give the last record to SST.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Flip Your Wig was like an amazing pop record, and, you know, in hindsight, it would have been much better to give that to Warner Brothers, where we ended up.
But, right.
You know, I mean, we were trying to, you know, sort of took one for the team and try to be nice on the way out.
But was that the last record?
That was the last record for SST, and there was two more Husker Du albums. Candy Apple Gray was the Warner's debut, came out in March of 86. And then Warehouse Songs and Stories was the last album for the band and Warner's, and that was January of 87.
Now, in this early community of hardcore, I mean, were you, like, openly gay at that time?
No. You know how military is don't ask, don't tell? My thing, it seemed like in hardcore to me, it was like, don't advertise, don't worry.
Yeah. Right.
Because all the, you know, it was all the freaks and the misfits and the weirdos and the artists and punks. And there was, I mean, it was just sort of like, yeah, you're probably gay. That's cool. Just, you know, don't be all
gay out there and that.
You know,
don't act all gay. Our bands don't do that.
Well, and I, you know, I mean, I, you know, I was gay, you know, but I didn't have a gay identity at that point. I was a guy who played guitar in a punk rock band. So
angrily,
yeah. Well, you were wondering where all that anger came from. You
was
know,
it that, from that?
Well, that was one of the things. Sort of being a self-hating homosexual.
But when you say self-hating, was it that you didn't accept yourself, or you were frustrated that you?
I accepted the fact that I was attracted to men, but I didn't fit into what I perceived the lifestyle to be.
And I think it was probably more defined then.
Yeah, I mean, there was a really strong definition. There was that, you know, the macho leather and sort of the effeminate, you know, drag, whatever you want to call it. And also, you know, the first time that Huskers went to San Francisco was July of 81, and that was like the moment when the word AIDS was brought to our attention.
Yep.
And that was the moment where Reagan couldn't say the word for at least 4 years.
Right. And ACT UP was created around that time to fight the sort of negligent, almost allowing of death.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's to me, a lot of the anger was, you know, not feeling like I had an identity within the community combined with the government telling me that I should die.
Right.
And you're sort of like, well, fuck y'all again.
Yeah. but you didn't have a voice around that. I mean, you couldn't feel that you could participate in that movement.
I could have, but I guess I felt more comfortable just being a musician.
Sure.
Like, there were people at that time who were doing incredible stuff, whether it was, you know, Sylvester doing amazing stuff on the West Coast, you know, Tom Robinson, Jimmy Somerville, the people who did the real heavy lifting, they self-identified, and that was their identity and their work. Mm-hmm. And to me, I was like, I just want to be my work right now.
Well, it's interesting like even within the work, because you would think within music mm-hmm. that there would be, but there were definitely different camps. I mean, mm-hmm. there were obviously out gay performers yeah. and people who we all assumed mm-hmm. was gay, and they didn't have any problem with yeah. that. But it was not in the world that you were in, that alt rock, punk rock. You know, it was not that type of world.
There were bits and pieces of it, but it just wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's for better or worse, I just wanted to stick to my craft, I guess.
Yeah. And it was and you wrote some great pop songs.
And if people go back,
yeah,
they're all gender non-specific. So again, it's the universal nature of the story.
But did you know that?
Yeah.
You're like, all right, I'm going to write in code.
Yeah, are you as miserable as me? Yeah. You know, I mean, the Smiths made a thing, you know.
Well, yeah, well, he's kind of a complicated character.
Indeed. And people love that, so.
Well, he was very, I mean, he spoke to that melancholy, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you definitely spoke, like, when I see pictures of you, when you were heavier mm-hmm. and sweatier,
yep.
you know, and just sort of, like, it was just this weird rage machine.
Yeah, it's like, how these guys get away from the gas station
right.
attendant
well,
thing?
Well, I don't, it was a little nerdier than that, I think. I projected that on there.
No, it's cool. I mean, we were very unlikely.
Yeah, well, when I saw you play recently, it's just very interesting that you can still, like, your energy is very directed, mm-hmm. and the songs sound cleaner and better, and your guitar yeah. playing is probably better than it was then, I'd imagine.
It's different. I think it's better, yeah.
Yeah, but the intensity of the music is still there, mm-hmm. even though you have some distance
yep.
from it. Can mm-hmm. when you play those songs, do you lock back into it, or is it more embracing? I mean, how does that work? Do you time travel?
I don't go back to that place.
Yeah.
And and there's certain songs, especially like side two of Zen Arcade, you know, it's just so visceral and guttural, and it's a lot of my songs, and it's a lot of anger and rage. I can't really conjure that specific emotion anymore. So, you know, within the Husker Du catalog, I go back to the poppier ones, the
right.
fun ones, the
right.
the, you know, sort of let's have a toast to punk rock kind of songs.
Right.
People love those. They're yeah. catchy, they're easy to play. And
conjuring rage is difficult.
Yeah.
And because it was sort of amorphous. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. multi-tiered.
Yeah, and you know, as I've gotten older and come to understand myself, it's not the most valid of emotions for me at this point.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because I have problems with rage.
You do.
I do. It comes upon me sometimes.
It's all right.
Is it?
It's all right.
when you were growing up, I mean, did your parents know?
I don't know. Maybe they did. It was never spoken about. And even when it was apparent and then public, still not spoken about. Even when I had partners and we lived together, not spoken about.
Huh. But yeah. not hostile.
Not hostile. Just don't speak about it.
Right. So. And are they still alive?
My dad passed a year ago.
Sorry.
October of 12. And yeah, so that was a changer.
Yeah.
But it, I had a great, you know, as good a relationship as I could have with my parents, given, you know, given sort of the chaos that I grew up with and, you know, the tension, the violence, the hypervigilance that puts in you as a child.
Wait, what kind of violence?
Physical stuff, you know.
Your dad?
Yeah, he get mad.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you grew up with rage?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, see, I didn't know.
Yeah, it's yeah.
And it, because I did as well. It's erratic. Was he a drinker?
Yep.
That was it.
And it wasn't erratic because it always the slow boil would start on Friday.
When he start afternoon. Knocking the cocktails
yeah,
back?
Yeah.
What'd he drink?
A beer drinker.
Oh, yeah? And he just saw it happen. You could sit there in the house and it's like, okay, so hour
it was
one.
It was like clockwork.
And it was about what?
And it was nothing. Just, you know, just anything, everything. Fucking customers, fucking this, fucking that. It's bang, 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 you know, and then like it's, you know, it's, and then Sunday night it starts to dissipate because we have to go back to school on Monday.
So like when you say violence, was that towards your, you and your sister? And
I didn't get as much of it
as
others got it.
Oh,
more
really?
Than me. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, part of that is right as I was born, there was an eldest child who passed.
And, oh really?
Yeah.
At what age?
9.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Did you
kidney cancer? So it was that transference thing. One leaves, the next one comes, I'm the golden child.
Oh my God.
And yeah, you didn't know I sort that of kid. Escaped it.
You didn't know that kid. No. So when like internalizing that, because I see I'm trying to sort of piece it together for myself. Is that you do you call you consider yourself alcoholic?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you've been sober a long time?
27+ years, yeah.
And when did you first get sober?
It was the summer of 86. I was 25 going on 26. I had not missed a day of drinking since I was 13. And
so you started drinking at home?
Yeah, because we had the grocery store. There was, you know, we sold beer. It's like I could make a six pack disappear anytime I wanted.
Yeah.
So it was always there. And then when I went to college, it was always there. And being in a band, it's always there.
So you had all this internalized, you know, frustration over not having a way to identify sexually,
mm-hmm.
and the way you were wired by mm-hmm. an alcoholic father, mm-hmm. and fueled by the booze,
mm-hmm.
and you had the freedom to just fucking, you know, beat the shit out of your guitar.
That and working in an environment where alcoholism is encouraged,
right?
Yeah.
And when it was that is what sort of, I imagine, pushed the band apart?
Well, just for, this is the summer of 86, and a number of things happened at once with Husker Du. I got sober, Greg Norton, the bass player, got married and moved to the country.
He's out.
And, you know, Grant Hart, the drummer, got involved with a bunch of different people and, you know, went down a personal path that I was not aware of until the very end of the band.
Drugs.
Yeah, so in that 18 months, you know, it just blew apart.
Yeah.
But because we were still working together, and then, you know, so that summer of 86, beginning of 87, Warehouse Songs and Stories come out. We have like a 3-month American tour, big theaters and stuff. The eve of the tour, our office manager commits suicide.
Oh my God.
So it's sort of like, you know, so that's...
This is a guy that's been with you for years? A
couple years, yeah.
And you were friends with him?
Yeah, yeah. Every day.
Was he depressive?
Yep.
Oh, you can't stop it.
No, it was, I didn't know how to process it when it happened.
Did you find him?
No, I got a call from his mother.
Oh.
And I didn't know how to handle that at all. And
had you felt like doing that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
You know, I toyed with it.
Yeah.
As much as you can toy with it. Like, well, I'm going to try this.
Well,
no,
you don't. You know, when you're an alcoholic or a drug addict, you just do the slow style.
Yes.
You don't want to commit to the task.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Just kind of slowly disintegrate.
Well, if I do that, I'm not going to be able to drink tomorrow.
That's right.
So it's going to cut into my bar time.
So that happens.
That's summer of 86. I woke up one morning, looked in the mirror, saw my dad, and just said, I got to stop. This, I'm not going to make it if I do this again.
Yeah, that weird, that day where you're all bloated and sweaty, and pale.
When you see the rest of your life in one snapshot, you know, and you're just like, oh my God, I am becoming
the monster.
I'm becoming this. I have to stop.
And okay, so you, what'd you do?
Just stopped.
Uh-huh.
Stopped cold.
And then where were you at creatively at that time? What was the plan?
We were working on, we were writing the music that would become Warehouse Songs and Stories, the last record that came out in 87. Our office manager kills himself, and then we go out on the road for a year, and we're all in a van together, and we're not talking. Not that we talked a lot by that point, but, you know, everybody's looking for the exit, but nobody wants to say it.
Yeah.
So we go through all of 1987, and then, you know, we were out doing some shows in December of 87.
Right.
And then it came to light that, you know, Grant Hart had, you know, had some, you know,
addiction issues
that, you know, that I didn't know about. I should have known. You know, I was right there. How could I not see?
Yeah. Didn't Did you feel betrayed?
No, I just felt like, oh my God, this is like, it's like people are dying. People are addicted. Everybody's different. Why am I here?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the saddest things about the breakup of Husker Du, one of the things that I really feel bad about is I left for my self-preservation, but in the years following, I didn't defend anybody else's choices. I just went about my business. And I think some people wanted to blame it on other people's addictions. And I'm like, no, in reality, this thing was coming apart anyways. It's just maybe that was like that showed me the way to get out.
You're talking about fans or labels?
Yeah, fans,
or
everybody. You know, the mythology.
Sure.
Mythology says. And, you know, my one regret, I guess, or my one, you know, one thing that I'm sad about with that is that I didn't, I neither attacked nor defended anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just went about my
business. Mind your business, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, in a way, I guess if I'd said the things I'm saying now then, maybe things would be different, but hey, you know.
You can't, well, no, you don't know to do that.
Yeah, not when you're, not when your own life, you know, not when you quit your life and start a new life.
Sure, and when someone else is in their sickness and you're in your sickness, there's no way to be diplomatic. Who the hell knows what those feelings are?
No idea. So, yeah, so, I mean, the band blew apart. It was not particularly ugly, and it wasn't pretty. It just sort of dissolved like, you know, like the end of a vacation or something.
Well, it sounded like, you know, everyone had an agenda, not necessarily healthy, but it sounded like the bass player knew where he seemed to, like,
he was
like, I'm done.
Hitting the links.
And then Grant was like, you know, he was out of control.
Well, he had left his current family of Husker Du and moved to a newer family of guys, musicians and stuff, that it was just a whole different circle of people.
Yeah, that so, lived, I mean, like him.
Similar kind of thing. And I'm just like, oh, I get it.
And this is when you hold up and made a workbook.
Yeah, at the same point as the band was blowing apart, I left the Twin Cities and moved upstate to halfway to Duluth in a small town called Pine City. I bought a farm up there with 10 acres and chickens. And
you still have it?
No, I lived there for a year and a half and I went insane.
So
I had to get out.
You took your Husker Du money and you like bought a farm
and sat up there and tried to figure out what I was going to do. So I sort of had to reinvent myself, because the last thing I wanted to do was, you know, make a record that sounded like Husker Du.
Well, that record, I think they just reissued it.
A workbook? Yeah, we just did that.
Listened to it. I know they sent it to me.
Oh, yeah.
So I listened to the vinyl. I'm big into vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a beautiful, deep record, but it's certainly not a Husker Du record. It's definitely lower in the volume,
mm-hmm.
a lot of acoustic,
yeah.
and just, you know, very lyrical, and it sounded very intimate. How much early on, since everyone credits you, certainly everyone, Husker Du, like, you know, people like Cobain and the Pixies, mm-hmm. and anybody who was involved in the next wave of independent music, mm-hmm. you know, you guys are like mythic.
Yeah.
Now, when did you become aware of that, and who sort of, did anyone guide you like into Sugar or into anything else?
So what happened is I made two records for Virgin Records with Anton and Tony.
Yeah.
Got pretty deep in debt. Virgin wanted me to renegotiate the deal.
Yeah.
I got a new attorney, and my new attorney, who's my current attorney, you know, I've worked with him for 20 plus years. He just said, you know what? Why don't you just walk away from that deal? Go play some solo shows. Go make some money. Write some songs. See what happens. So in 1991, I spent almost the entire year out doing solo acoustic shows.
How'd that go?
That was great, because I would just write songs and try them out for people, and it was very low pressure, no record company leaning on me.
Because I remember that time. I remember thinking, like, how difficult is that? Because, you know, when I first heard Husker Du, and then when you made this transition, I'm like, where'd the other guy go?
I know. He was just taking a break. So 91, I'm doing all this stuff. And as it turns out, in the summer of 91, my booking agent had me working in Europe all summer. And I was playing these, like, you know, these like boutique festivals with Sonic Youth, who I was friends with. And, you know, Dinosaur Jr. was on a lot of the shows. And Nirvana, who I remember because I had gotten the demos for what became Nevermind as a possible producer.
Really?
Yeah.
And who ended up producing that? Butch Vig?
Yeah. It worked out best for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wouldn't have nearly done that.
Who produced the Husker Du records?
We did them ourselves. Yeah.
Man, because I mean, they definitely took something from you, because like when I listen to the Husker Du records, everything's way up.
Oh yeah. Everything's up front.
Yeah. Cause I listened to a vinyl of Nevermind and it like doesn't make any difference,
uh-huh.
cause everything is like fucking, you know, way up.
Yeah.
So yeah, they must have, that must have been what they were looking for.
Yeah. So, but Nirvana were on a lot of these festivals. So I would watch them and they were trashing the stage every night. And I'd have to go out after them with a 12 string. You know, it's like I'm up there doing my Richie Havens thing. So just trying to keep the crusties involved.
How did the Husker Du fans respond?
Throwing shit, you know.
Fuck you, get off the fucking stage.
Really?
Dinosaur Jr.
Really?
Yeah.
That's funny because Jay's going out with a guitar and some pedals now by himself.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, yeah, so the irony was not lost on me. I was just like, wait a minute.
I invented this.
Wait a minute. You know, do you have that Deep Wound single? Jay and Lou and the Four Dinosaur?
Yeah.
But, you know, and that was also a lot of the tour that became the year punk broke, you know, the documentary.
Yeah.
So all this is happening and I'm writing these songs and I'm thinking about making a pop record with loud guitars, and then Nevermind comes out. And then I meet with, at the end of 1991, I go over to England and I meet with Alan McGee, who was running Creation Records at the time, you know, real great label.
Uh-huh.
And he was a huge fan and he heard some songs and he had a lot of faith and he said, I'll sign you. Don't have a lot of money, but I can get you a lot of work. I said, great. I came back to America, got together with a label, Rykodisc, who were, you know, a really good indie label at the time, did two separate deals, and then, had a bunch of songs, got a bass player named David Barbie and a drummer named Malcolm Travis, got them together for what was ostensibly to be the third Bob Mould solo record.
Right.
We were working in Athens, Georgia, did like 3 weeks of rehearsing 30 songs to get ready to make these albums. 40 Watt Club calls us and says, hey, somebody canceled. Do you guys want to play on Tuesday? And we're like, sure, we'll play a show. And then we're like, what are we going to call this?
Yeah.
And we're at a Waffle House in Athens, Georgia. I look down, there's a sugar packet on the table. I said, how about sugar? Yeah. Like, okay, cool enough.
Sugar.
Yeah, so that's it. So the next day we're playing a show is this band called Sugar.
Yeah.
And then we go up to suburban Boston and spend a month making what would become Copper Blue and Beaster together.
Fucking Copper Blue is such a huge record, man.
Love that record.
It's fucking great record.
Love that record.
But all of a sudden, like, whatever break you were taking, you're fucking back, man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
on the guitar, it's like a wall.
Yeah, and you know, so
who produced those?
I produced those with a friend of mine, Lou Giordano, who was an engineer out of Boston, who actually did live sound on the road for Husker Du for the last couple of years.
So he knew.
Yeah, oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. We were the architects of this thing. You know, in ways.
So we're Husker Du fans, like, he's back.
The UK press was very much like, oh my God, he's back.
Yeah.
And again, this is 9 months after Nevermind.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the history is Husker Du sets the table for the Pixies, My Bloody Valentine, Nirvana, Shoegaze, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then I go to Creation, you know, and in Europe, it's like, he's back.
Yeah. Right.
So it's like they set the table inadvertently for me.
Yeah.
And people, you know, and the thing is, people always get on me about this, you know, do you feel vindicated or do you feel like, you know, I'm just like, man, this stuff just happens. You know, it's like, I'm fine with loose change. It's
right.
Cool. I don't need the whole bank.
And you're working too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's important to keep working.
Yeah. I'm working and working and working, and we're touring hard and we're going to Japan for the first time and, you know, all these amazing opportunities. So Sugar is this 3 albums in 3 years condensed insanity.
Did that sell more than anything else you did?
By far.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because that was because the entire culture of music changed.
Yeah.
You were at the beginning of it and you didn't earn off of that a lot. But then, like, what you invented came back around and you re-entered it and it killed.
Yeah. Pixies, Nirvana, they set it up.
Yeah.
And I just come back and then everybody's used to it now. Then all of a sudden, vocal slightly under distorted guitars isn't that difficult to understand.
Right. It's become mainstream music.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fucking sweet. Yes.
So it's nice. So yeah, and even to this day, you know, when people do that, I'm like, you got to be kidding.
You know?
It's like, what? You know, me and Butch Vig were working together, you know, in the old Smart Studios in Madison in 84, making Tar Babies records together. I know this drill. You know, it's like we sort of did this thing.
Y'all did it together.
Yeah, it's like we just do this thing because we love music, you know?
Yeah, but you guys are at a level of it that, you know, to be as creative, it's a weird thing, and the same with comedy or anything else, is that who the hell knows who makes the cut, but usually the guys who hang in are the guys who really, you know, deserve it.
Slow and steady.
Yeah.
Yep.
And what do you do I mean, I know you've put out a lot of records since the Sugar Records, but what were some of the things that you let yourself do that you never thought you would do musically?
Well, I mean, after Sugar, you know, after Sugar disbanded in 95, I started working on, you know, a solo record at home, and it was more lo-fi. You know,
where are you living?
I was in Austin, Texas at that time, and really into stuff like Sebado, Guided by Voices. So I was like, you know, it'd be really fun to just make a record at home. And yeah, I started getting into that, made a couple solo records, one in 96, one in 98. And then the record that I made in 98, Last Dog and Pony Show, was my farewell to rock. You know, 20 years in the van, 20 years being a rock guitarist. I wanted to be a gay guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I moved back to New York City. And I was like, I want to get my other life going.
How old were you?
What did
you
decide? 38.
So you're like, I'm ready.
I'm ready now.
I'm ready to take on the identity.
I'm going to the gym. I'm hanging out on 8th Avenue. You know, I'm going to Fire Island. So in 1999, I really got into the gay lifestyle. And, in New York, that was amazing at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it created all of the archetypes that, you know, everybody copies.
Uh-huh.
You know,
what'd you luck into?
What did I look into?
Are you a bear?
Now, but then I didn't know. I was trying to shave my body and have six-pack abs and all that weird shit.
You did?
I tried it. It didn't work.
Funny. So you went through what a lot of gay guys go through in their mid-20s.
Yeah, or their late teens. Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, like, yeah, weird colored underwear.
How do I fit in? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. So, yeah, so I did that, and that led me to electronic music.
So was it a relief?
It was finding a new way of life.
But I mean, like I have to assume that like to make that decision and to engage that freedom finally to say like, all right, let's feel this out. Yeah. I mean, it takes a certain amount of courage, even though you're compelled to do it, you know, anyways. But I mean, was it fun? Was it?
Yeah.
Like,
well,
I was
longtime partnered and monogamous, so I didn't really, you know, wasn't like, you know, wasn't fruit salad all the time.
Yeah,
for me.
Yeah.
It was sort of like, just let's hang around, see what happens.
Yeah.
And, it was crazy, you know, like hanging out with like porn stars and you know, all this, you know, this stuff that you think, you know, like you're like, oh my god, this is so gay.
Yeah.
and it's really fun. So I'm doing that in 99, but like in August of 99, I got a call to go work at pro wrestling.
What?
Yeah. Well, do you not know about this?
I think I saw a little, I forgot. I'm glad you brought
it
up. Are you a big pro wrestling guy?
Yeah, that was my thing as a kid. You know, there were kids like baseball, like comic books.
Well, you like Kiss.
So I was like pro wrestling, Kiss, Spectacle.
Yeah.
So, you know.
How did you get that call?
A friend of mine named Gary Jester worked at a company called World Championship Wrestling, and that was the TBS Turner AOL Time Warner Wrestling.
Uh-huh.
They were the direct competitor to Vince McMahon and the WWF at the time.
Uh-huh.
And they were having a shakeup in the creative side, and I had been giving them ideas all throughout the 90s, and they knew that I knew the business, and they said, why don't you come in and be a creative consultant? So I got
in
there.
They just knew you knew as a fan?
Yeah, they knew that I was smart. You know, I'd gotten smartened up. I knew how it all worked.
And they were looking for scripts?
They were looking for new ideas.
Yeah.
Something fresh, something different. So I went down there and just got thrown into the lion's den, and it was amazing. It was a really amazing time,
and it worked.
It worked as best I could. There was a lot of things that derailed my ideas. Other people came in, and I did not have seniority or power. I was just this guy who had really good handwriting, could produce a show on the fly.
Yeah,
good with math, good with, you know, kept my head down, said yes sir, no sir, and
but you had a good time.
I had a great time. I mean, man, that's a whole separate book.
Yeah.
Thing. I mean, it was really, really, really great stuff. Because I got there, like they brought me in on a Sunday night for a pay-per-view, and I watched it in the production truck with the new boss.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, "What do you think of this? What do you think of that? What do you think of this?" I said, "Well, this should have gone longer. That, you don't want to really expose that guy's weaknesses. You know, this storyline could work, but I'm not really sure it makes sense."
Uh-huh.
And so they're like, "Okay, so come to TV, come to Monday Nitro tomorrow, and meet with Hogan."
Yeah.
So they put me in a room with Hogan right off the bat, you know, the shrewdest politician in the business at
the
time.
And were you a fan?
I was a fan of the business.
Okay. Yeah.
to be nice.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm talking with Hogan. I'm running this idea by him, and, you know, he said, sounds good, brother. All the time saying, who's this fucking Mark?
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So, where'd this guy come from? And but you know, I hung in there, stuck it out. They found a spot for me. And as it turns out, the job that I ended up with was working at my Showtime job was gorilla position. And to explain what gorilla position is, in the old days up in Northeast Wrestling, Vince Sr. and Vince McMahon, and they had a guy, Gorilla Monsoon. He was a wrestler.
Yeah.
And he was the one that would, in the old days before wireless and everything, during the matches, he would come down, he'd walk from the back to the ring, go down and just nod at the timekeeper and walk back. And that was the signal for the guys in the ring to finish.
Yeah.
And he would sit behind the curtain and give everybody their instructions. So they call it the gorilla position.
Uh-huh.
So doing Monday Nitro, we're doing 3 hours of TV live every Monday night. We would start at 8 Eastern. WWF would start at 9 Eastern. I'm sitting behind the curtain. Our show with time code on the left side, their show with time code on the right side. I'm sitting there with a script, 16 segments that we have to do in 3 hours and 8 minutes. And we have to hit our marks. So the first 5 segments, the first hour. Segment 6, we have to get on the air at 8:59 so that we can trump their hot
open. Start it, right.
We trump their hot open.
Right.
We do all our ballyhoo and, you know, Hogan running and all that shit. So I'm sitting there. I'm the last stop for all these guys to get their lines, their cues. So I'm doing this, watching their show. So when they go on commercial, I get on a wireless mic and tell the refs, they're on break, speed it up. So that we try to do gimmick. We're doing all this Zabada to keep
you're
people
actually,
on our show.
The two networks are wrestling.
Yeah, we're competing, and yeah. I'm sending signals to the boys in the ring through the ref who's got a wireless.
That's hilarious.
Oh yeah, it was nuts, the stuff that we did.
But it was a blast.
Oh yeah,
right?
It was a blast, and met great people. You know, just great people. Kevin Nash, who was like NWO guy, big sexy. He was Diesel in the WWF.
Uh-huh.
And he came over, and he was sort of running the locker room.
Yeah.
And at the first booking meeting, I sat in and I didn't say much, but I was taking good notes and keeping stuff straight for everybody. We took a break and walked out, and he goes, "You're a musician." He goes, "Are you gay?" And you know, this is the first, like, second day in, and I'm sort of like, I said, "Yeah, I am, Kev. Is that going to be a problem?" He goes, "Nah, I have a lot of gay friends. You smoke pot?" Like, "Yeah, sometimes." "Like sushi?" I'm like, "Hell yeah." He's "Right on, brother. You're riding with us."
The initiation.
Yeah, it was just, and then we were, you know, it was
sushi,
like a group of us. Yeah,
sushi
pot, talking, sitting up till 3 a.m. in the hotel, talking old 70s Detroit wrestling with the Sheik and Bobo Brazil. And,
oh my God. You know, so you're really
crazy
in.
Shit. Like, you know, Bobby Shane, the original king of wrestling in Florida.
Uh-huh.
Crazy, you know, watch the donkey matches in Amarillo in 58 and all the shit, you know, gimmicks, you know, try to come up with shit.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed, I don't know a lot about wrestling, but I interviewed Punk, CM Punk.
Yep.
And, you know, he's a great guy. Yep. And I saw that documentary, Beyond the Mat.
Ooh, that's tough.
What's that guy's name? The
Jake Roberts?
Yeah.
You know, Jake, he's totally turned his life around.
That's amazing.
One of the other ex-wrestlers, this guy Diamond Dallas Page, came up with this yoga thing.
Yeah.
And he also, like, Jake was one of his mentors in the old days. And he brought Jake out to Atlanta to live with him. And they started filming it like a reality thing.
Uh-huh.
And he got him clean.
He got him clean
and sober. He looks great.
Really?
And Jake was one of the best minds in the business. It was sad to watch that movie. But he's turned it all around.
That's amazing.
Mick Foley, Terry Funk. Oh,
Mick's a great guy.
Work with Terry Funk.
Mick's a great guy.
Yeah, Mick. I've met Mick a couple times.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart.
Yeah, really good writer. Really great. Just does a lot of fun stuff for kids.
My partner, Brendan, in this thing, in mm-hmm. WTF, he grew up with the wrestling thing.
Oh,
so
boy.
He knows all about it, and he gets real excited about
it. Yeah, Punk's a good guy. I never met him. I knew about him, like, back in... You know, 2001.
You know, Colt Cabana.
Yeah,
you
know, Colt. He's got a
podcast.
Art of Wrestling.
Right, and he modeled it after this show.
Excellent.
And I interviewed him when I was up in Chicago.
Yeah,
and he told me about that whole independent wrestling thing. And
well, Punk was like straight edge, like the X on the hand, like Discord, Minor Threat, DC Punk Rock. Yep. So it's all good.
Yeah, it's it is very the spectacle of it, the show of it, the people that love it really love it, and it's one of those things that I just like. I think I'm a little too old to lock into, but I definitely appreciate that people really fucking dig it.
And it bums me out when people are like, "Oh, that's fake." It's like, well, it's predetermined.
It. Yeah,
it's choreographed. It involves complete and absolute trust in the person you're doing all this crazy shit with, because they could accidentally drop you on your head and kill you.
Yeah,
And it's like Cirque du Soleil meets like Shakespeare.
No,
it's these morality plays.
Exactly. That's what it is. You've got your face and you've got your...
You got babies in heels. Yeah. It's all that's... Yeah.
So you're doing wrestling and you're doing electronic music.
Yeah. What the hell?
Did that stick? That didn't stick.
Yeah, it did sort of stick. It got me to a couple different places. I made an electronic record called Modulate in 2002 that... A lot of good ideas, but I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
2003, I moved to Washington, D.C., and met a fellow named Rich Morrell, and we started these DJ nights called Blow Off in 2003. You know, I got to D.C., I didn't have any friends.
Yeah.
You know, I just split from my partner once we got there, and I'm like...
And you moved to D.C.?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, from New York, so it was...
It's weird.
Yeah. So in 2003, started DJing and, you know, did... You know, got and you know, that's sort of how I was expressing my electronic and dance side more. Uh-huh. And then, you know, started easing back towards guitar rock as the aughts went on. I made a record in 2004 called Body of Song. District Line was, I think, 2007, Life and Times in 2009. Yeah, and then that sort of, you know, gets us up to when I started working on the autobiography.
And you're comfortable.
More comfortable, yeah.
Well, I think it's fascinating to me that you did something that rarely happens in an artist's life, is that, you know, you hit some sort of place where you allowed yourself to evolve and to continue to become comfortable with yourself. Mm. That was the, you know, you knew there was a price to pay on some level.
Yep. Yeah.
But it was more important for you to realize, you know, what you're fully capable of and, you know, take risks and try to embrace, you know, the things you were afraid of.
Are you the kind of guy when you make a shift, when you know you're going to make a shift like that, are you like a when I go, I'm gone? Like, here's my thing, I'm going to move on, so I'm gone, I'm not looking back.
Well,
you know, like real hard turns.
I don't know if I ever had anything that defined me that specifically, because I was as an artist, if I call myself that, it was just a sort of the way I framed it is it took me about 20 years to arrive in myself. Mm. So if I look at my anger period, which was not marketable, no one was celebrating me. Mm. I wasn't paid to be that way.
I
was a marginal act that had, you know, clearly anger problems. And I think as it didn't work. Mm-hmm. Like, I believe that, like, well, everyone must be angry and bitter inside. So why aren't they relating to me? And then I realized that, well, no, a lot of people aren't that way. And it's not necessarily entertaining. So it was never that drastic. It was sort of a slow coming into myself what it really was.
Okay. Yeah, because why I ask is because, like, these things were end of rock, beginning of gay. Oh, and pro wrestling. What?
Yeah.
You know, like, I would just do these, like, sort of real abrupt breaks.
Well, that was an opportunity that you chose to embrace. I mean, you didn't see it coming. It wasn't like you were, like, I'm pounding on the door of the pro wrestling world.
Yeah.
Those are those decisions where it's like, well, that sounds fun for a while.
Yeah, and this isn't going to happen again next year. I better do it now.
Sure, why not do that? Yeah, well, that's different. So now, how did you, like, I want to come back to this in the sense that I know your father passed away and that you had, now that I know that there was this, you know, this horrendous dynamic that you were able to transcend somehow.
It was what it was.
Yeah.
It was what it was.
Yeah.
And one of the things.
But are you at peace with it? I mean, was it a slow death?
Yeah. It was a long last lap for him. It was tough, you know, it's a couple of years, you know, COPD that, you know, and then eventually they, you know, found the, you know, big tumor and lung cancer. And, we, you know, had some really good time together towards the end, you know, both when he was very aware and as he was transitioning out. And, it was really, you know, my dad was this gigantic figure in the family that, you know, was never challenged, and, you know, had made it hard, you know. So, you know, my siblings have different views, and I just felt like I have to really go and try to understand his life while I have the chance to try to learn about my grandfather, his father, and the stories, and then it's this way.
Empathy, compassion.
I'm so sorry.
Really?
I had no idea. And then it's okay.
Huh.
You know, and then all of a sudden it's like, of course everything's forgiven now. It all makes sense now.
Wow.
And, you know, so then, you know, it's, so now I'm the messenger to the others and trying to do that. So
did he apologize?
I didn't didn't want one.
No.
I just wanted to know what happened.
Yeah.
You know, is because we all have, you know, this is the thing. You tell stories. I tell stories.
Yeah.
We do this thing. We unknowingly build these legacies. Everybody in the world does. And if you can't get, if you can't create clarity with your legacy before it ends, it's sort of, it can be lost, misunderstood.
Or tumble down generations.
Yeah, and of course you catch it, and you know, again the day that in 86 when I looked in the mirror and saw my future, and I didn't want that one. So yeah, I mean it was great for me. It was great for me. It gave me a lot of clarity, a lot of extra clarity beyond the things that I had figured out. You know, absolute peace, absolute peace.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I mean, as much, you know, I'm sure there'll be, you know, there could be flare-ups at any point, but it's, yeah, I mean, I'm happy I took the time and took, you know, accepted the challenge, I guess.
That's great.
To me, it just really, I needed to know the story.
Huh.
I needed to hear the story from the source and not the you know, the mythology or the realities we create. We make the distance from our families and create these realities, you know, and have, you know, and then we have this story that we carry. And then, you know, when you find out, like, wait, somebody took out chapters 4 through 8.
Right.
You
know? And it's also why wrestling is compelling, is that those stories, you know, are very, there's a line.
When it's good, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did, you wrote the theme to The Daily Show.
Yeah.
And I remember that. And because you're friends with Liz Winstead.
Yes.
So she, how did that happen? Do you still make a few bucks every time they play it?
Yes.
That's great.
I'm grateful for that. It was a wonderful thing. Liz Winstead and I were friends in Minneapolis in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And hung out a lot together.
And she was one of the original creators of The Daily Show with Craig Kilborn.
Yeah, it was, who were the other? Yeah, Craig was the original host.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then things changed later and Jon Stewart came in. But Liz came to me with, you know, we're putting this show together. We're going to call it The Daily Show. And, you know, we'd like you to, do you have anything that would work really good for theme music? And I said, well, Liz, I just finished a record and I have two instrumentals that I think might be okay. And I'll, you know, I'll let you hear them both and pick the one you want. And they picked the and that was had a dummy title, Dog on Fire, because I couldn't come up with any words. And I recorded a version for the show.
Yeah.
And that became the theme and is still the theme song to this day.
It's great that he kept it.
Yeah, it's really, I'm so grateful.
Yeah,
I'm really,
nice.
Really grateful for that. Other people, you know, people re-recorded it and changed it a little bit, but I mean, I'm still the creator, so it's cool.
That's nice, man.
Yeah,
that's
really great.
That's nice to make money while you're sleeping.
Yes, I like that.
All right, so do you want to play or you feel like it or no?
Really? I'll play a song, yeah, give me a song.
All right, hold on, let me set it up.
Okay, let me see. All right, song. And all these songs I write for you, they tear me up, it's not hard to do. Listen to my voice, it's the only weapon I kept from the war. From the war. From the war. From the war. And I can soothe every ailment you endure. And I can see into the future most assured. Well, I don't have a choice, it's the only voice I know. From the war. Up from the war. Up from the war. Up from the war. And everything we made reduced to dust. You were the one who taught me most to. I'll carry your remains, your emblem and your name.
and nothing left will ever be the same. And this war we fought was violent and long. Weeks turned into years, but we kept on keeping on. The ringing in my brain is what remains. It's what remains. It's what remains. War has worn me down. Broken dreams and a hole in the ground. Don't give up and don't give in.
Great.
Oh.
Thank you, man.
It's a heavy deal, right?
It's a very heavy deal. I really appreciate you coming.
Thanks, Mark. It's been really fun. I'm a big fan. Love the show.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks,
man,
for having me. I appreciate it.
Who knew? Did you know that stuff? Professional wrestling? What was that? What? Huh? I love it. I love Bob Mould, and that song was... I love when people play in here. I love what I do. What can I tell you? Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Seriously. Wow. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.